Right.
Well, I knew Ann Queen when she first came here. The president of the university doesn't deal as directly with student organizations as most people think, because that's really the job of the chancellor. But having been a dean of students myself, I took more than a casual interest, and that's why I got to know her. And my wife Ida was on the board of the YWCA, and in fact, I think was chairman of it at one time. And she helped to get people into the program. So my whole family's been involved with the Y program in Chapel Hill. Ann Queen is what I would call out of the mold of Chapel Hill. And let me explain what I mean by that. Having seen a lot of universities all over the country in 35 years, you get to the point where you wonder why there are such differences among these institutions. They all teach, they all have research activities, and they all engage in public service. But what is it that makes it so different when you say somebody's from Chapel Hill, or somebody's from Madison, or Ann Arbor, or Austin, or Berkeley? Those are the great public universities in the country. And I think it's this. I think it's that young people, when they go through the experience of Chapel Hill, get so much more than just classroom and laboratory experience. They learn how to live in the world. They learn to get along with people. They learn that compromise is the way to advance an idea, never giving it up, but moving in a constant but gradual movement forward to achieve a longer objective. Now, the reason for that kind of process is that you learn as you do. And I believe that the reason that Chapel Hill conducted itself the way it did during the post-Kent State problems and the Vietnam problems was because students here knew first they could speak their mind. They knew that they could speak to anybody they wanted to, the president on down. But they also knew that when they were free to do these things, they had to act responsibly, because there is no such thing as freedom without some sense of obligation and responsibility. Because if you try to assume that, then it's anarchy. People don't act within the context of a democratic process. So I believe that the difference in young people who go through and really work at the experience of being a student here gain so much more in the sense of maturity and judgment and experience that they're ready to take on the world when they leave here. You don't find this in every institution, regrettably. Well, Ann Queen is one of those spirits. I used to tell her she was den mother to the whole student body if they wanted to come to her house, you know, because her place stayed open all the time. There was never a time when you couldn't go by there and find students sitting and talking and arguing and debating. She was a marvelous, and still is as far as that goes, but a marvelous personality at helping students think these things out, you see. It's one thing to react emotionally to something because you feel it and believe it, and that's good. It's also, though, the mark of an educated person to have that sense of motivation, but to have the capacity to reason and think all the way through it to a resolution or a solution out there. Well, that's what Ann did. She was a catalyst. She was a stimulator. She was a den mother. She cooked. She sewed. She did all these things because her whole life was given to young people. And she got such enormous satisfaction out of it that I don't believe she was ever tired. She was running full speed from the moment she woke up in the morning till she put her head on the pillow at night. I don't think she ever quit working and moving and challenging and doing and serving and, you know, touching the lives of people. She, I know of no time that she ever faltered, and I knew her pretty well. Our means of communication was always through the telephone or by meeting each other and talking. We never worked in the structured formality of the university because it was not possible. But there was never a time when she ever doubted that she could pick up the phone and say to me, this is what we need to do, or this is where I need some help. And I would explain to her what I could do or couldn't do. We were perfectly open with each other. And that way, she was a very valuable person to me because I knew when I heard what she had to say that she was reflecting the consensus from students, which is any university administrator needs that, you see, if he's going to really work with young people. I'll put it another way around. Any chief administrative officer who didn't develop that is throwing away one of the greatest assets he could have. So she moved through all these years and the lives of all of these people as a positive, challenging, stimulating, motivating, spiritual force. In other words, she lived, in my view, a very noble existence here. Never easy, always with stress. But you see, the demarcation of people like Anne Queen is that they have inner peace. They can take on all these controversies because it doesn't upset them. They know what they're dealing with. And I'm sure the person she loved the most, cared for the most, was Dr. Frank Graham. And he taught her that. And the rest of us, too. I mean, I consider myself as much a student of his as Anne. Now, that was a generation at Chapel Hill that you don't see today, regrettably. And I don't know why. I don't think what I characterize as the experience or the demarcation of a graduate of this place, I think that's still true. But I don't, and I'm sure it's because I'm not in touch, but I really believe what happens here is of such force that it carries you with it. And she had that experience here, lived it to the fullest, and still do it. I keep getting notes from her all the time. She watches a little television program I do, and she's my resident mountain critic, I call her. But I think my characterization of her as den mother to the student body is about as encompassing as you can make it.
Right. Well, I wanted to ask you about that. I wanted to ask you a little bit about the environment for women on campus while you served as president. What was it like, and how did Anne work with the women at this university?
Well, you know, when I first came here, there was not open admission for women at all. And then when you asked Governor Sanford about this, he, when he was governor, and I, and a man named Dallas Herring down here, who was at that time head of the school system for the state, created what is known as the Carlisle Commission. That work is really going to be a very profound item of history in this state when somebody takes the time to evaluate it, because out of that process came the opening up of the university, where all four-year degree-granting schools became arts and science campuses. We opened up the admission of women. We opened up UNCG for the admission of men. We delimited the range of doctoral training, projected the development of the community college system, actually outlined the development of the university by taking in the campuses at Charlotte, and Wilmington, and Asheville. All of this you see in one particular report. Now, once it became true that the old policies that were very restrictive for women were to go, well, you know who jumped right in the middle of the emergence of that new idea, and that was Anne. And look at the result of it today. Women predominate in enrollment here. And this is true at NC State, I found that. There are more women now applying than males. Well, it's the new day. Now you do these, you make these kinds of changes for many reasons. First, economic. You couldn't afford to have big university plants that weren't open to co-education. Secondly, it is the way you want to have the academic experience, because that's the way life is out there. You know, men, women, male, female, you work that way every day of your life. So why have such a sequestered arrangement when you're reaching the years that are important? Well, Anne, one of the great skills that Anne Queen possesses is that she never lost sight of where she's going. And it was always forward. But she learned long ago how to do that with grace and style, so that even when you disagreed with her, you could never get angry, because you knew that ultimately she'd wear you down. You know, it had to happen. And wear you down because the idea she had was right. It was the idea itself that you finally saw through. You know, you had to do it. And it was not a matter of resistance. It was just a matter of how much can you achieve at one time, and scheduling things and programming things. But she was and is a person who, I don't think her mind ever sleeps. She's just stirring up ideas all the time. And that's what you want around a university community. You absolutely have to have an Anne Queen to work with young people.
That's great. Can you comment a little bit on some specific incidents during the period of upheaval when you were president? Were you president during the sit-ins in the early 1960s? How did you see her role during desegregation, speaker ban, food worker strike, and Vietnam?
On all those issues, you knew where Anne Queen stood philosophically. You knew where she stood intellectually, and most of all, where she stood spiritually. It was never a question there. All you were doing in working with Anne Queen was deciding how to get there. Whether you had to work in the context of 90 days or 12 months or 2 years. And she learned and was wise in dealing with the very hard fact that a public university has so many forces it has to deal with, you see. Unlike a private institution, the legislature, for example, public opinion en masse, political rights, political lefts, male-female arguments, abortion cases, all these kinds of things. Mm-hmm. You live in this cauldron of controversy. So when I said that she's a person of inner peace, you knew where she was going to be. You didn't have to debate that part of it at all. You just said, Anne, how can we move from A to B, in your opinion, as we go down the road together? She was a marvelous person who, one of her great skills was she listens. You know, so many people want to spend all the time talking. Anne is a listener. And you get along in this world a lot faster when you develop that capacity, especially when you're dealing with human beings in a sensitive situation such as a university.
Great. Can you comment specifically on what you can remember about her role in the Chapel, with the Chapel Hill Human Relations Committee during the food worker strike negotiations? Can you recall?
That's not something I know that much about. I'd mislead you.
Okay.
But I know she was a force. There's no doubt about that.
Why do you think that Anne was so effective with the students in particular, and also with the administration and then the community?
Everybody trusted her. You know, that's the key ingredient. Trust, and they knew that she loved them. You know, these were her children. Anne played that role, not mother, but you know, listening post, confidant, counselor, all these words fit her. And that's what she was.
How do you believe that her unique background from the mountains contributed to the way that she dealt with young people and also administrators.
You ever know a mountain person that was impulsive? Never in your life, most of them. They're deliberate people. They're careful people. And they're people that know what adversity means. And they use adversity to grow. You know, that's an important point. There's a lot of people look for an excuse to quit trying and to quit doing. Mm-hmm. And as one old friend of mine around here said one day, he said, you know, some people, given a circumstance, will grow in it. Others will swell up. You know, when they're given a chance to really lead. And I don't think she ever entertained for a moment, any thought of selfish gain in anything. Anne Queen never set out to be president. You know, for her to have, for anyone to even intimate that she would use a situation for personal aggrandizement is about as foreign as it can be. And it's that sense that you had when you were in her presence. You know, she was not manipulating things. She was not wheeling and dealing with another person's life. She was rock honest. Or Chancellor House used to say about another person here, she's just plain distressingly honest. I always thought that was a great phrase.
Wow. Well, can you comment perhaps on how you believe that Anne's convictions, you talk about her inner peace, how was that translated, and how did she show that inner peace and that spiritual side of her to her students?
Well, it was not a matter of wearing her religion on her sleeve. Mm-hmm. It was just that you knew that here was somebody that you could sit down with who would be as honest as they knew how to be, who would be as helpful as they knew how to be, who would be as encouraging, stimulating, but truthful. She'd tell you when you were wrong. Not in any mean way, that's my point. Mm-hmm. You don't find many people like this lady. And when you do, the tendency is to overwork them because you want to, you know, do so much. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what Anne's stress points were, but my guess is that she had a tendency just to do that, to push herself to the extreme limit at times, at her own, wearing herself out in service. Now, I'm sure that, you know, we all have our faults, we all have our ways of doing things that irritate some people. I hope not many. But that's just who we are. This is coming around to the other point about her. She accepted you as you are. She didn't try to remake you overnight. She didn't lecture you, you know, about any thing that you were doing that was she knew to be questionable. She'd show you by example.
Great. If you would use one phrase to, well, several phrases, however you would like to put it, to tell us why Anne Queen is so admired by so many from so many areas around the university community and beyond, how would you summarize that up?
Well, you can't use one word to embrace a life like that. I like to feel that the real measurement of anyone's life is whether or not you've made a useful difference. That is, the fact that I was here, lived these years, worked at this job, and am now gone, did it make any difference? In her case, all that you've heard is the testimony of the affirmation that she did. Now, why do you make a difference? Because you're useful. You teach by being and doing. and you work at what you want to do. In other words, sit around and talk philosophy, religion, faith is one thing, but to talk it and then go do it is another thing. She was always the person that put action behind words. Now the more conservative people didn't agree with her, didn't approve of her, you know, criticized her, sure. But no one ever questioned that principle about her. And they never would.
Can we backtrack just a bit? And if you were to describe the environment of upheaval while you were university president, how would you describe that within the student body and in the community?
What happened here was, in lots of ways, a reflection of what was going on all over the country. Yes, there was student unrest, student anxiety, student concern, and you would hope that the day would never come in a university where that would not be the case. Because if it isn't a vigorous, volatile, debating, challenging kind of atmosphere around here, I think you're a dead institution. You might go through the rote of teaching, the regimen of it, but you don't educate. And it's a cyclical kind of thing. You go through a period of years like that, and then everybody just so weary of the whole business, you begin to hear words, well, this is the conformist generation. They're not going to challenge anybody. They're not going to upset the boat. All they want to do is make money. Remember your contemporaries 2 years ago?
Yeah.
Well, now it's changing again. You wouldn't be sitting here if it weren't changing. Look around you. The Peace Corps is coming alive again. So many things where young people have said, no, it isn't making money. You have to make a decent living to provide for yourself and your family. But to be obsessed with it, to have greed as the consummate aim in life, is to have no life at all. And that's the cycle that maybe I'm wishfully thinking, but I don't believe it. I think enough of you are saying, you know, this isn't the way the world's going to be. You have got to get along with the German, Japanese, Chinese, Indonesian, Afrikaner. You've got to know these people. You've got to know what kind of world you're going to have. You don't do that by sitting over here in the corner. You do that by working at it and making mistakes and growing out of it. That's who she was. Somewhere, and I don't know where, but somewhere back here in her life, early on, that happened to her. It's just as clear to me, and I've seen thousands of people in my 30 years here, and you get to know certain things about character and personality traits and motivation. And every once in a while, somebody comes across your vision like Ann Quinn. And you just say, gee whiz, if you had 30 of them, you turned the place upside down. I don't know if you could survive 30 of them, but it'd be worth a try. But that's she came along in years where that the personality that she was, the experience that she was, all came in full flower. She was a necessary person. Now, lots of people would tell you, well, circumstances create the personality. You know, you find yourself thrown into a particular thing. You hope that you've got within you the character and the integrity and the drive and the energy and the commitment that you'll take hold, whatever the situation is, and deal with it. Well, I think time and circumstance and personality coincided here. I don't know, Anne wouldn't be very happy in a collegiate atmosphere that was motivated only by qualifying myself to make money. Now she'd rail against it, but I don't think she'd find many wanting to join her. You know? Well, in those years, everybody was getting into something. Very few people didn't have an opinion. It was a very stimulating experience, but also one that drains you completely. Because people like Ann, you see, and anybody in the administrative structure wouldn't be here if they weren't sensitive to young people. And you are always trying so hard to help you see and understand why a decision has to be made a certain way. Because the tendency at that stage of our lives to view everything in black or white, it's yes or no, there is no middle ground. Well, she helped get across that. Yes, ma'am. All right. That's the way she worked.
Wow.
As you can see, I have great affection for her.
Definitely. I just have a few more questions.
Sure.
To comment, you're making sort of references to her knowledge of the university environment and the realities of the pressures from the legislature and being a public university. Can you comment on how she was able to dispel some of the violence that was possibly brewing within the students that she worked with and the potential radicalism that could have come about at this university?
Just by being who she was. You know, when somebody is that personality type, walks into a meeting and just stands there, doesn't say anything, it quiets it down. And she was not afraid to take on people who had not the pure motive, but the motive of radicalism. And she could see it. You see, she had discerning capability. And they were there, don't mislead you. We had all kinds of people who were speaking up and some who were really trying to use the situation. Very few. But people do that to you, you know.
There's been a lot of criticism that the liberal community in Chapel Hill was living on its legacy of liberals such as Frank Porter Graham and Howard Odom and Paul Green. How would you comment on that criticism?
I would first ask who's making the criticism and see where they stood, you know, because a famous old dictum, you never know what the chief thinks till you stand in the chief's moccasins.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot in that. The difference today and the difference in the years that Dr. Graham was here, and I worked for him, so I can speak some experience, is the television cameras here. And there are people crawling all over you for interviews and all that. You didn't have that experience.
Mm-hmm.
You live on the front page or on the television screen. And there isn't that much news every day, but if there isn't something there, they'll go out and try to create an incident. You know, you've seen this happen. And that's an unfair allegation. Tell me which is the freest university in the state today. Tell me which university didn't violate the law during all of those crises. That was Frank Graham's number one principle. Frank Graham never advocated the integration of the university until the law said so. He was a great respecter of the legal process, the sanctity of the law, and that was precisely the position that I took. So I talked to him and I understood what he was. His great liberalism came from his personal actions in trying to get the human heart to understand that all men, meaning all men and women of all races, sat down together. That was his whole strategy. Well, I think the institution itself, well, I have people ask me, what did I look back upon as the most important thing I ever did? Not that anything that I ever did was important, but I'd say the first thing, with me always, keep the university free. Speaker ban law was put upon us under outrageous circumstances. You know, they suspended the rules. There were no hearings. We weren't given notice. They jammed the thing through. We tried one process. We couldn't get it reversed, so we went to the courts and it was done. No man has the right to ask you to disobey the law. See, that's the reason you go that route. And I have to be a lawyer, so I naturally think that way.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Do you have any closing comments you'd like to make that, and perhaps things that we haven't touched today, about the campus-wide, perhaps, or Ann's, has left this university?
Let me put it this way. The great need in society today is for people who think in terms of why people, individuals, every one of us is entitled to certain fundamental things. The right of an education, to live freely and without fear, the right of protection and personal privacy. And when you assert that and take that stand, you're also saying that I'll take my share of the responsibility to maintain that as a democratic society, as a free community. That process begins in the home, in the school, then in the community, then the state, and now our country. This is why the Ann Queens of the world are so important. They understand that. They work very hard to see to it that you understand. Now, you'll do it in a way that'll be different from this person, or that person, or the next person. But all four of you will be thinking in the same general direction. That's what her mission was. And I believe it very deeply. And I'd like to be associated with it. That's what I tried to do when I was here. And the important thing is a never-ending struggle. Not that there's a devil out there to be overcome, but when you make this change, then there's another one that's better. And then you just keep moving. And in my lifetime, I can count off of you. There was no television when I was a boy. There were no jet aircraft. There were no space explorations. There were no sulfur drugs and all these things. Well, when you're my age, you look back and say, there were no this. When I left here this morning and had lunch in Brussels and back home tonight in my bed, you travel 5,000 miles an hour, whatever you're going to do. All these things, you see. But what you don't lose sight of is that all those things are true and wonderful. It's what's happening to you that counts. And therefore, what you do to be a useful American, that's the lesson that she tried to teach, in my view.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
For your time
today. Very nice to see you, Ms. Cheatham. Have a happy holiday.
It was the prize. And it was now $15.95 or something like that. He says, well, I don't have the money right now, of course. And I had to go back to all my customers to try to make them take the map. Well, they didn't have the money, and it was right. So I was supposed to take anything they wanted to give for it. And then I would go borrow, you know, trade it. Well, some of them I said, I'll pay if you let me stay here to sell it. So I sold that all right. And then there's others I say, well, I have to eat. I take it out in food. And I did that all right. But then when you came to the man that didn't have money, just like you, you know, you said, yes, I'd like to have one. Then you'd say, well, I don't have the money. Well, there's nothing I can do, because you couldn't pay for it. And I got stuck with, God, I don't know how many orders. People saying they wanted it, but didn't have the money. So I sent my report back into, I guess it was Chicago, and they said, well, you are not really delivering them right. I said, well, I take them there and I say, here they are. He says, yes, but suppose it's a man who has a clothing store. Now you wear clothing. Take out a piece of clothing and say, well, I'll give you that for this. Well, I soon ran out of clothing that I needed. I rented a horse from the nicest fella in a town that did not even have a railroad station. It was 3 miles from a station. And the man in the hotel sent a Ford there to meet the customers. So I went in to see him and I told him what I was going to do. He says, well, of course, I can't be sure you're going to be able to sell them. And I said, well, you want one of them. And I know they're going to sell. And he says, yes, but I don't know they're going to sell. He says, I'll tell you what you do. I'll do. I'm going to give you a room. And you can stay up there as long as you have cash and sell money. See, that was no good. But I was stuck then. And when I got, so I got the maps and couldn't sell them. On a lot of orders. The man from Detroit wrote me a letter and said, I'll come down and see you and I'll help you sell them. So the same man who helped me do them on paper came down there to sell them. He did, and he did what I refused to do. He says, well, you promised to buy it. Well, they had not. They said they liked it and would like to have it. And I says, well, they did promise to buy it. I said, they said they liked it. He says, well, now look, you're not used to selling things. So he says, I'll go with you. So he went with me and God sent them. And when they didn't have them, he says, well, now I have your name right here. And he says, I bought these maps. And he says, you're going to have to take them. He says, anybody would tell you, put your name on the line there. Well, I couldn't argue because I didn't know enough. And so I had the fella, let him come on and try to sell them. And he failed. And he says, well, now the problem is, you're right, you can't sell them. Because if those people sold farm products, they had a big drought. Nothing to do with that. Everybody, all the farmers had no money. So you see, then there was nobody that had money to buy. So I was stuck in a place with nobody with money. So Mr. Jones came down to see me. And he says, well, let's not give up. You're a good salesman. And he says, Texas. He says, they got cattle down there. And you make shoes. They got sheep. You shear the sheep. He says, there's nothing needed that Texas hadn't got. And I says, well, I ain't got nowhere to go to Texas. I'm broke now. He says, I'll give you an advance. Then you go to Texas, you know you can sell there with the money they got. So I passed through Nashville on the way to Texas. And I called my father, who was working in Texas then, in the oil field. And he was making almost nothing. And he says, you know I'm selling the maps here. He says, I'm making only $3 a day because there's no money here. But if all of these wells come in, there's going to be money here. But don't count on it till they come in. He says, I'm working at almost nothing. Count on that. I've got a little money to buy. I was going to buy a cafe. And he says, then nobody got the money here. So I told that to Mr. What's his name, Jones. And he says, well, you see, one thing your father didn't tell you, and that was that there are a lot of people drilling wells. And says that you don't get a well running in everywhere. You have to go where they're being drilled. And that made sense. So I called Paul again. He says, well, I'm not getting work yet. I've been trying to get it. But he says, I advise you to go home a while and give time to wells come in, which I did, and I went home, and it didn't come in. So I was left without a job again.
You went home?
To Nashville.
So, and they never came in, so you just stayed in Nashville?
I called him from Nashville, told him that, and he says, well, my mother says, well, I don't know what you're going to do, but you know you can stay here as long as we got something.
Okay.